accession number 18802, reel 4.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 4. You were saying that after the fighting at Tassinano, the two battalions of the Rifle Brigade were merged. Can you remember much about the actual fighting?
No, I can't. It's a very serious deficiency, because I ought to be able to remember it. There's a very good account of the battle written by one of the company commanders in the town, which I can direct anybody to if they want to see it. It's a very good account indeed. He's always been reluctant to write it because he felt it was all too personal and so on, but at last he's been persuaded to do it, and it's quite excellent. But broadly speaking, two companies of the 2nd Rifle Brigade were dispatched into this town, Borgo Tossignano, and elements of the 10th Battalion as well. The other battalion in the brigade at the time was the 7th Rifle Brigade, and they were sort of they were in reserve at that particular time. But the long and the short of it was that a phrase I've often used called sunray optimism, which is it happened quite a lot on the way up Italy. People were saying, oh, they'll be gone by the time you get there, and quite often they were, but then quite often they weren't, and on this occasion they weren't gone at all. And so the general cry was, oh, you know, you just walk into the town and take it at night and that'll be that. But in fact we lost two companies plus a bit, and it was as a result of that battle that the 2nd Battalion and the 10th Battalion amalgamated. And as far as the detail of the battle is concerned, my recollection is virtually nil. I was completely overtaken by events. I was not in the mind of the commanding officer, and I really didn't quite know, A, what we were supposed to be doing, and B, what actually happened. And I suppose that's a fairly good example of the fog of war.
Were you still acting as intelligence officer?
Yes, I was, which is why I say I ought to know something about it. The main thing I remember about it is that the second in command of C Company of 2RB was not around at a particular moment when the mule train was supposed to go forward to supply this lot in Tossignano. At that time, nobody thought there was a serious problem. And so they looked around and said, well, you know, I was the dearest person available, I'd better take the mule train. And I was getting ready to do just that when the second in command duly turned up, much to my relief, because he was taken prisoner later that night. And I suppose the same thing would have happened to me. But you would think as the IO that one had a very clear picture of what was going on, and I absolutely did not.
Was that the normal state of affairs in Italy? Or did you generally have a reasonable idea of what was happening?
Generally, I had a very reasonable idea of what was happening. And in particular, we knew a great deal about the order of battle of the German army. You know, having established what division one was opposite, one was able to deal in a good deal of detail about the regimental structure in that division and its strength and all that sort of thing. But unfortunately, on this particular occasion, we did not know who was against us. And just in passing, one of the interesting things, I think, about the German structure at that time was how much they still relied on horse-drawn vehicles and horse-drawn artillery and that sort of thing. I mean, of course, there was a lot of panzer as well, a lot of self-propelled artillery, but we were surprised how much horse-drawn was still about.
Can you think that there are any advantages to having horse-drawn equipment rather than motorised ones?
Not really, no. I mean, I mentioned mules and our front. They were an essential part of performance in the Apennines, because the vehicles could not go. It was as simple as that. But I think there's a difference between mules being loaded up with packs and horse-drawn vehicles. I think there's a complete difference there, and I wouldn't see any advantage in horse-drawn. But no, I feel very, very guilty that I'm unable to say any more about that battle, because I ought to be able to, and I can't.
You mentioned that you knew a lot about the German order of battle. Where did you get that information from?
Intelligence summaries. When I first joined, well, just before I joined the battalion and was doing courses in Egypt, in the base depot there, I did a 3-inch mortar course, that was all right, and I also did a regimental intelligence officer's course, and so one was taught then all the things to look for and how to keep records and that sort of thing. And thereafter, one relied on the divisional and other intelligence summaries, which were pretty accurate on the whole.
What about gathering intelligence from your own resources?
Patrols, mainly. Indeed, when I was a platoon commander, I was sent out on various patrols, including one on my 21st birthday. Don't think we covered that at an earlier stage. And usually one was sent out with specific questions about a particular route or a particular hill or a particular something or other. Occasionally one was sent out on a fighting patrol with a view to catching a prisoner, indeed for intelligence purposes. And my 21st birthday one was actually a fighting patrol. We didn't make contact, well, not direct contact. And when I came back in, I found the commanding officer and the company commander and various others all assembled saying, "Happy birthday, sorry we had to send you out."
When you went on your birthday patrol, can you remember where it was that you did it?
No. I can't.
Roughly how many men did you have with you?
I should think we went out about 20.
And did you know exactly what route you were going to take before you set off?
No, I think it was. We knew where we were going, and we knew exactly what we were trying to do. I think it was rather left to us to find the best route to get there and cover and all that sort of thing.
What sort of ground were you going over?
Some of it was road, a mountain road. Some of it was sort of scrub and that sort of thing.
Do you remember what kind of distance you were expected to cover?
Not very far. I mean, I should think we did a total of 5 miles during the night, I think, something of that sort.
Did you move all as one body, or were you divided in any way?
We were a body, but moving in sort of groups within that body, in what I suppose one would describe as the normal way. But again, my memory fails me. Although you'd think it was an important event in my life at the time, it was. But looking back on it, it's just, you know, one thing chalked up my birthday, and what happened then, I really don't remember.
But you didn't actually bump into the enemy or make contact with them?
Not directly. We were sort of got shot at from a distance, but no more than that.
How long did the patrol take? Would you be out all night, or was it part of the night?
About 5 hours, I would guess. Yeah.
When you're out on that sort of patrol, which of the senses is the most important?
Ear. To me. Obviously eyes as well, but ear. And I suppose to an extent instinct comes into it a little bit as well, but ear is the main thing. And you stop a lot to listen. But to an extent I'm muddling up that one with other recce patrols that I did with much smaller numbers of people, moving much more slowly. And that was designed not to make contact, but to avoid contact and to produce answers to specific questions.
So on a recce patrol, what numbers would you take?
Oh, 5 or 6, probably.
When you're going out on such an exercise, in which stealth is obviously very important, how did you maintain control of the soldiers and...
Well, partly we all knew each other very well, and partly we reacted instantly to individual peoples. If somebody suddenly stopped, well, everybody stopped and adopted the right positions all round about and so on. And so, to an extent, it was, if there was a moon or something like that, sign language, or whispering. But we were all very close together under those circumstances, and merely spread out if we stopped and thought there was a problem.
When you were choosing men for such patrols, did you look for the same qualities in those you would take on a fighting patrol as for those you would take on a recce patrol?
Yes, I regarded... at the time I was a platoon commander, and I suppose the strength of the platoon was... It was down a bit. I suppose we were about 28 by then. And I suppose there were perhaps one or two people who one would have preferred not to take. But on the whole, we were all in it together. And one tried to share out these things in an equal manner, so that everybody had a go, on the one hand, and everybody had their share of being frightened, or more frightened than usual.
Did you ever come across anyone who actually enjoyed going out on patrol?
I don't think I ever asked them that direct question. There's a certain element of excitement about it, of course, a considerable element of fear and danger and all that. But I don't think at that stage of my life I sort of identified people who were, let's call it, gung-ho and who wanted to go and do that sort of thing. And if I had, I think I'd have slightly distrusted them. Because, by and large, one is looking for... obviously, initiative, energy, action, enthusiasm, all those things. But one's also looking for a degree of native wit, native caution in approaches to these sort of problems.
Now, you mentioned that there were some soldiers you'd rather not have taken with you. Why was that? What was it about them that made you dubious?
Perhaps one was clumsy and made a noise and was really incapable of curing himself of that problem. And one who quite definitely was edgy. And indeed, he eventually disappeared altogether. But by and large, everybody was in it together, and everybody reacted in a thoroughly sensible, and to use an old-fashioned phrase, rifleman-like manner.
Now, on this particular patrol, the object was to snatch a prisoner. Do you have to remember why you wanted a prisoner at that time? Was it to establish who you were up against?
I think probably. I don't remember. That would be the normal thing.
Do you remember getting aerial photographs down the intelligence chain?
Yes. I don't remember them being in huge quantity, but yes, we got some aerial photographs. But I think it was relatively early in their development by then, possibly, I'm not sure, certainly in Italy. And also because of the contours and the terrain generally, a lot of it really wasn't suitable for air photographs, for the sort of work we were doing. But there were some air photographs, and yes, we were trained how to read them.
Why would the contours make photographs unsuitable?
Well, perhaps that's the wrong phrase. I personally think air photographs are most useful for towns, in particular, street fighting and so on. And also, looking long after the war, for, let's call them internal security operations, if you're trying to pinpoint particular trees or particular things in a bit of countryside, then I think they're extremely valuable. But I think, just trundling up the usual hill, I don't think they're tremendous help. Unless you're expecting to find dugouts and things at the top, in which case it's quite handy to have a picture of the layout, but on the whole, one wasn't doing that.
Do you recall if you had any finds on prisoners of war? Did you ever find significant, useful papers on them or anything of that sort? Or get any tactical intelligence out of them?
I don't think so. I only came across one senior prisoner of war, and the awful thing is I've now forgotten his name. I used to remember it. And I quite forget how he appeared. I think he just appeared at battalion headquarters, and I was sort of dispatched in a staff car to take him back to divisional headquarters. And so, you know, I suppose we conversed a little bit on the way back. His main contribution was to say, well, you watch it, we'll all be in it against the Russians in due course.
And that was the Nazi party line at the time, of course.
Yeah.
So at least he was being consistent.
Yes.
What about contact with the local population? Did you ever find partisans or friendly civilians giving you warning of German positions up ahead or information of any other sort?
We had the odd, and I didn't really come across it very much. There was one partisan in particular, I remember, who got attached to the battalion, I think for guide purposes as much as anything else. The sort of thing in Malaya later on, one had talked about a tracker. I think he was that sort of person. I really never came across him much. Most of the civilians we met were just terrified, and understandably so. And, you know, if one asked if the Germans were about or gone or whatever, they always said they'd gone. And usually they were right, because they would be too frightened to do anything much if they were still around. But I don't recall meeting sort of great groups of population. I mean, it was usually isolated farmhouses and things like that.
Up in the mountains?
Yes, and also in the plains to an extent.
When battalion headquarters was set up, how was it normally located and organised when you were in the mountains? And did you get under hard cover? Did you have, particularly if it's a camouflage, the location?
We usually tried to get into a barn or a house. In fact, I don't think... this was in what I might call the static part of the battle. Otherwise, we were just in vehicles trundling up the road or track or whatever. But in the mountains, I think we always tried to get into a house, and I do not recall, I don't think, a single occasion when we had to be, as it were, dug in, tented, or whatever you like to call it.
Roughly how many of you would there be in the headquarters if you got into a building?
Well, we would be looking for a series of buildings. I suppose battalion headquarters at that time was about 30, I suppose, something of that sort, between 20 and 30.
Did you have a regular system of briefings every day, morning prayers, or did you have your business organised ad hoc?
I think mainly ad hoc. And, you know, if the commanding officer decided he needed to say something, well, people were called together for him to say it. But I don't remember a regular briefing or prayer session.
Did he,
of course, came into my life later on, and I've always practiced that ever since.
Did he have a formal style of meeting when he called a meeting? Did he go through a sort of set pattern?
Yes, I think most people did. I mean, there was an acronym once upon a time for that sort of thing, and I forget what it was now. But yes, we all, I think, at the various levels, went through the same general order of events.
And did he ever issue written orders, or was it all done...?
Mainly verbal, but occasionally some things confirmed in writing.
And would it be... did he use maps or diagrams, usually, in his in giving his orders?
Yes.
So the pattern would be he would give his orders
using the map or diagram, and the company commanders would take notes.
Yes.
And then they would go and do the same thing.
Yes. Occasionally, when it was suitable, they were handed over marked maps which had been prepared by my lot.
Mm. But who was in your lot? Presumably you had a section.
Very small section. Mm. And I had a sergeant, a corporal, and one other, I think.
Were any of them trained as draftsmen, or did they just...
We just learnt as we went along. Mm.
What was the quality of the maps like once you got up into northern Italy?
I think mixed is probably the right answer to that. Looking back, perhaps they were better than one might have expected. I honestly don't remember. But we seemed to get on all right with them.
Do you recall if they were coloured and contoured, or if they were some other style?
They were certainly contoured, and the small-scale ones tended to be more coloured than the large-scale ones.
Was there an information policy in the battalion? Policy of disseminating information down to the troops?
Yes, as a policy it certainly existed, and the theory was that as much as anybody knew got passed on the basis that people would react rather better if they knew what was going on around them. And indeed, I think it's relevant to that. I happened to be looking through some old standing orders of the Rifle Brigade yesterday, and I found one which I thought was very much applicable today and really applies to that question. A regiment of riflemen is expected to be one where intelligence is to distinguish every individual, and where both officers and men are able and ready to act independently and separately from each other. Well, that fits in with information policy. The more you tell people, the more they can do that.
Who was responsible for this work of pushing information down the chain?
Oh, through orders. I mean, through company commander's orders, platoon commander's orders, and second commander's orders.
So you didn't have a specific responsibility for doing it?
No, it was the normal chain of command. Right. I mean, occasionally I used to go around the companies and talk about individual German divisions or something like that, but the main information was quite definitely a chain of command, and so I think that's right.
Presumably, when orders were given out, it would come in situation, wasn't it, at the beginning of the orders, and then enemy forces, friendly, and so on.
Yeah, exactly.
Did the soldiers show an active interest in the information you could give them?
Most did, yes. One or two, I suppose, brushed it aside a little bit. But, yes, most did.
So they really didn't want to know what they were doing? And why?
Yes. But then, I think, rather that little bit I've just read out, that, let's call it philosophy of behaviour as between officers, soldiers and so on, is inherent in all the training and background of the rifle regiments. And I suppose it's something that deep down we're all steeped in. And so it's automatic to exchange views and ideas amongst ourselves, regardless of rank. Having exchanged views, things then become orders, and once orders are given, well, that's that. And
orders
you get on with
orders.
It. Yeah.
Yes. But you have a fairly free-form discussion before eventually the senior officer or the senior man present decides what to do, makes the plan, issues.
Yes, I wouldn't want to overemphasize that, but yes, to an extent, and certainly just sort of chatting up amongst the different levels, saying, what we're going on with now is so-and-so. Ooh, I wonder why we're doing that and not that, but it's all sort of friendly stuff. Nothing subversive about it at all.
And it was policy to explain as well as...
Yes, very much so.
And did this happen at battalion orders as well? Was the commanding officer receptive to questions and
yes.
suggestions from the floor?
Yes. And indeed, I mean, you know, as time went by, and for instance, when I took a battalion to Aden later on, we always practiced that as a sort of, you know, an exchange of views and then decision as to what was to happen and get on with it.
We can move on from Tosinano. This obviously had a great impact on the two battalions. How did the merger go? Was it a smooth...
Well, we all knew each other, thinking now at the officer level. I mean, there was a great... many people had trained together and sort of knew each other. I think there was a certain amount of suspicion at one stage because 2RB and 7RB had come from the desert. 10RB had come from North Africa. And they were regarded as sort of different.
8th Army versus 1st Army.
Exactly.
Get your knees brown.
Exactly. And so to that extent, I suppose there was a certain amount of suspicion. But, you know, we all had a job to do. We all wanted a functioning battalion again as quickly as possible, and so we all got on with it.
Was there any significant difference in approach that you noticed amongst those from 1st Army? Had they learned different lessons from their experience from the ones that you'd learned from yours?
I don't think so. I mean, if they had, it didn't emerge. I mean, obviously there were different personalities between the commanding officers concerned, and so that perhaps was the biggest difference. But no, I mean, we all came together and got on with the job as best we could.
How about the soldiers? Were they happy?
Yes, because, well, I mean, again, I'm sure there was an element of suspicion at some stage and at some stages and some levels. But, of course, one tried to keep platoons and, to an extent, companies together as much as possible. And so, I mean, the company I had been in, for instance, A Company, 2RB, well, that continued to exist almost as it had been before.
Because it hadn't been fed into the town.
Exactly. And so, to an extent, life went on very much the same for people who were in that particular subunit. And so I think as long as you kept friends together as much as possible and those who sort of fought together as much as possible and didn't destroy groupings, any sort of amalgamation of that kind can work perfectly well if people put their minds to it.
And so the amalgamated battalion, the sort of second stroke tenth, as it were, they went on.
They went on and became known, of course, as the second battalion, as the senior battalion. And so the 10th battalion had to be replaced, and they were replaced in the brigade by the 1st 60th. And so it was still a green jacket brigade as opposed to a rifle brigade brigade.
Another point I should have raised just now about the soldiers from the two battalions, were they from different areas of the country? Did you notice any geographical...
I don't think so, no, because it's a terrible generalisation and broadly speaking, but we were still basically a London regiment. And so whichever battalion you were in, you tended to come from Stepney or from wherever. There were, of course, some people who were known as Swedes who came from the countryside roundabout, but my recollection is that most of us regarded ourselves as a London regiment still.
What about the 1st 60th?
They're much the same. I mean, traditionally, over the years, those areas have been the recruiting grounds, both the Royal Brigade and the 60th. Having said that, I mean, obviously there were people from other parts of the country.
Where did you go after Tosignano, after the amalgamation? What happened next?
I've no idea. And we proceeded up Italy. I mean, the Germans eventually went from Tosignano. And we proceeded up Italy, and the nearer we got to the top, the faster it all seemed to go.
Well, you could perceive the German resistance. weakening as you went further.
Yes.
Was Tassie Nano the last serious fight?
I think it was, is my recollection.
So
that may not be so, but it's my recollection, yes. I mean, there were odd skirmishes thereafter, of course.
Bumping rear guards.
Yes, and I mean, one thing I remember in particular, when we really were moving quite a lot every day, and we fetched up in an overnight Liga, and battalion headquarters set itself up, and we, in almost desert formation, with sort of some tanks were with us as well, and the soft bit in the middle and the hard bit round the outside. And an SB Garten appeared down the road.